Marketing. It's the art of influencing, persuading, and gently nudging people towards your products or services. I've had a chat with the grandmaster himself of influence and persuasion, Dr. Robert Cialdini. Hey son, Svejsan! You tune into the Link Humans podcast and I'm your host Jorgen Sundberg. This is where I speak to the innovators out there in recruiting, HR and marketing. What's going down? It's gone pretty cold here in England. Lovely sunny days complemented with icy Siberian winds. Our big event is happening this week, SM London Live. If you're coming down, please let me know. And if not, feel free to follow the action on the hashtag, which is, of course, SM London. Now, have you read the book Influence? Arguably the most influential, ironically, book about the psychology of marketing. It was written by Dr. Robert Cialdini back in the 80s, and it has inspired many others to write books, articles, and to do podcasts on the topic. Now, it's not very often that I get starstruck when interviewing someone for this podcast, but I did actually have a case of it when I had and I got the chance to speak to Dr. Robert Cialdini at his new book promotion at a hotel in London. Let's roll the interview and we'll see if he can persuade you, or should I say persuade you, to get his new book. Dr. Robert Cialdini, how are you?
I'm well, Jorgen.
Now, tell us about what you do.
Well, these days, I'm a researcher, scientist, and author on the topic of influence and persuasion.
And what took you so long to write this this book, Persuasion, which is the prequel to Influence?
Well, you know, a long time ago, I did write Influence, and it focused on what to put inside a message to move people in our direction. Right? And it proved to be so successful that I didn't want to just plant a set of bushes around the tree that influence had become. I wanted to wait until I had the seed for another tree. And that took me a long time before the idea for persuasion came along, which is about the process of arranging your audience to be sympathetic to your message before they encounter it.
And who is the book aimed at?
Well, it's aimed at anyone who is interested in moving other people in their direction. So, certainly, this is true in the professional arena, but it is also true in the personal lives of your listeners, how they can arrange for friends or family members to be more agreeable to their persuasive appeals.
Okay. And if we go through some of the concepts in the book, first of all, what are privileged moments and how can marketers take full advantage of these?
Privileged moments are the moments that we create immediately before we present an idea or proposal or recommendation, so that people are attuned to that idea, recommendation, or proposal before they ever encounter it. And we do that by creating a mindset in them that is consistent with the goal of our message.
And could you give us an example of a privileged moment in action?
Certainly. Here was a study that I like to talk about. It was done by some marketing researchers who walked up to individuals and asked them to participate in a marketing survey for no compensation. Only 29% of them agreed to participate under those circumstances.
Yeah.
But if the researcher first asked a persuasive question, do you consider yourself a helpful person? People thought for a moment, and almost all of them said yes. Then the researcher said, well, could you help us with our marketing survey.
Yeah.
And now 77% agreed. So you can go from 29% to 77% assent, right, by changing the state of mind that people were in before you asked the question. Put them in mind of their helpfulness, and they want to be helpful as a consequence. They want to be consistent with that view of themselves that you've now raised to consciousness.
That's also an old sales trick, isn't it, to get people to say yes, 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 and then when you finally hit them with the sale, they're more inclined to say yes?
There is an old sales trick. It's called assuming the sale and asking for a lot of affirmative answers,
right,
to the questions that you bring up. So now people are in an affirmative state of mind.
Yeah. Okay. Great. And what type of marketing efforts and consumer product reviews are most successful online?
Well, the kind that turn out to be best are those that come from people just like us.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are reviews, there's a site that focuses on mothers, right, and what they can buy for their families, for their children. And they've broken the site down into categories. Mothers of children from certain ages, mothers of children of twins, mothers of children who have come along after a long gap from the last year. Right? And what they find is those mothers go directly to those categories, right? They don't just go to the general mother review. They go to the people who are just like them.
Right. Okay. And what's this shop called?
I can't recall the name of it, but I do remember that they impressed me with the ability to segment their market,
right,
and direct people to the categories of reviews,
yeah, yeah,
that were most comparable to the visitor.
And I think also in the workplace, which we'll talk about in a minute, there is a site called Glassdoor, which does a lot of employer reviews, which seems to be doing extremely well at the moment. And I think, like you say, people, they identify with others and they trust that information more than something coming from the top, perhaps. One question for you. Why should online photographs of fluffy clouds help to sell furniture?
This has to do with the way that we've moved recently into digital marketing, e-commerce, and so on. Of course, someone who wants to use the persuasive moment to move people in a direction of their yet-to-be-delivered message, right, should recognize that the first thing a visitor sees to a website is the landing page,
mm-hmm,
and probably the background images on that landing page. There was a study done in which an online furniture store sent half of its visitors, just as a test, to a landing page with the background wallpaper depicting fluffy clouds.
Right.
They sent the other half to a landing page with background wallpaper depicting coins, money.
Okay.
Those who saw the fluffy clouds in the background then rated comfort as the most important feature in selecting a piece of furniture, a sofa, for example, right? They then searched the site for comfort-related features and ultimately preferred to purchase comfortable furniture. Those who were sent to the landing site with coins rated price,
yeah,
as the most important feature, searched for cost-related aspects of,
wow,
the furniture, and preferred to purchase inexpensive furniture. So what occurred first, before they were ever even introduced to the material and the details of the offerings themselves, was that people were put in a mindset, either for comfort or for cost, that directed them subsequently into the material, caused them to search in a biased way through it, and become more inclined toward that initial concept that was installed in their mind persuasively at the very beginning of their contact with the site. Now, there's one other thing that's interesting about that. No one recognized that they were influenced by the coins or the clouds. They said, of course not. I decide based on my own preferences.
Yeah.
They didn't recognize that those preferences were shaped by the first thing they saw on that site.
So in a way, you're really hitting someone's subconscious?
It is a subconscious. It's not subliminal, which is below recognition. People don't even see the thing. Sometimes you can flash something quickly they don't even see it. No, they saw the coins. They saw the clouds, but they're not aware of the influence of those factors on their choices.
Well, okay, so back to the websites. This is a real marketing question here. Should you try to prime people in your USP right at the top of your website? So if there is a process to follow, in other words, if priming is so important, yeah, should it be the first thing to read when they hit your website?
It should be.
Yeah.
Because we've just detailed in that clouds or coin study that then channels their attention in a way subsequent that allows the rest of the site, right, to present its strongest elements. So you can focus people on a particular idea that may be your strength. Is your strength comfort? Is your strength cost? You can focus people on that material in a way that will make them recognize and process that information more quickly, more deeply.
Interesting. Okay. And why can our perception on what's important be so easily shifted? And I think there's a mention in the book about how the U.S. government used this to their advantage during the Iraq War.
Yeah. So let me just say generally, what this process is suggesting is if a communicator shifts a person's attention to a particular factor,
yep,
that person sees that factor as more important than before because they are paying attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the logic. Normally, what we do is to direct our attention to the most important factors, the most important features in our environment. That's what we typically do. So when we see ourselves paying attention to a factor, we assume that it must warrant that attention. It must deserve that attention. Because normally, when we attend to something, it's to an important feature.
Sure.
Right? We make the mistake of assuming that that's always the case. Because a communicator can send us to a particular factor and focus our attention there for reasons that have nothing to do with the merits of that thing. They can do it by illuminating some aspect of that factor that draws our attention. Distinctive colors, for example, will do that. Placement on a shelf can do that. There's a study that shows that if you walk into a supermarket and there are three brands arrayed on the shelf, you will pay attention to the one in the center. And as a consequence, be more likely to purchase the brand that's in the center. That's why brands spend so much money to secure particular shelf space in supermarkets. They know that particular placement directs attention, and attention implies importance, and people then buy in a way that's congruent with their perceived importance of that brand.
And back to the Iraq War, what did the U.S. government do with this technique?
There was something called the Embedded Reporter Program.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
They put news journalists in the same settings to live with, to eat with, to travel with soldiers. And the consequence was those embedded reporters got the majority of front page space on newspapers around the world, right? Because they were so close to the soldiers and to the soldiering that was going on, which caused their reportage to be about the conduct of the war rather than the justification for the war in Iraq.
Right, yeah.
Why the U.S. was there was not the focus of their attention. But their attention was on, who are these people I'm with? What are they eating? How long are they sleeping? How are they performing in battle? So it was about the operation of the war, which the U.S. actually did fairly well, not the rationale for being there in the first place. Remember, the rationale was weapons of mass destruction?
Right, yeah, yeah.
That okay. never appeared.
Mm.
Oh, it appeared in 2% of the reports of the embedded reporters, whereas stories about soldiers and soldiering appeared in 71%.
It's interesting, though, because to my memory, the embedded journalists, the U.S. didn't allow that since the Vietnam War, because in the Vietnam War, that sort of backfired a bit and it turned public opinion against the war. But in this case, it was actually in favor of the war.
That's right, because in Vietnam, the war did not go well.
Right.
In this case, the combat went well.
Really well, yeah.
Right? So this was where you wanted reporters focusing and then readers focusing on their reports on this particular aspect of what was salient, what was prominent in attention, was something that was a side effect of the decision to invade, right? It was a consequence, not the decision itself, which had real weaknesses.
Yeah.
And what the U.S. government did was to deflect attention from the weaknesses onto the strengths.
So in hindsight, is there any persuasion technique the U.S. government could have employed to get more public support for the actual motives behind the war?
Well, a persuasive strategy?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things they might have done was to use commentary before the intervention of experts from around the world that this was necessary.
Mm.
So to create the aura of a unified point of view from those who are most knowledgeable about this, that the invention. Now, that unified point of view didn't exist before. So I think if they had selected just those voices, they may have been successful to some degree. They would not have been honest in the presentation. So I would find that ethically objectionable.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Right. So if we look at triggers, what triggers are typically most effective?
Well, you have three kinds of triggers of persuasive moments. There are the words you can say. So, for example, we gave one example of that. Are you a helpful person?
Mm-hmm.
Say the word helpful. Cause people to reflect on their helpfulness, and then they behave in a way that is congruent with it. You can also do it with situations, and you can do it with imagery. images. Mm-hmm. A situational example has to do with a good demonstration of this in a study done in France. Researchers had an attractive young man approach young women who were walking through a shopping mall, right? Stop them, give them a compliment, and ask them for their phone number so he could call them for a date later on. When they were passing a variety of shops, a shoe store, a clothing boutique, a pastry shop, his success rate was very low, 13.5%. Mm-hmm. But when he was passing one particular kind of shop, his success rate jumped to 24%, almost doubled. It was a flower shop. So the setting of a flower shop and the association of flowers with romance put those young women in a romantic state of mind. And now potential romance was more important to them than avoiding potential risk, because that's a risky thing to give a stranger your phone number, right? In a shopping. But in a amorous state of mind, in the setting of a flower shop, that became prominent in consciousness, that became more important, and they behaved in ways that were significantly consistent with it.
So what kind of trigger would you call that? Is that environmental?
A setting. The setting is a flower shop. They weren't even in a flower shop. They were just passing a flower shop.
Yeah.
That was enough. Now, so let's then talk about the last of these, which is images. And we've already talked about the images of fluffy clouds, images of coins. Mm-hmm. But here is the one that I think is the most powerful of all the studies I've reviewed. It was a study done in Belgium. Researchers brought subjects in to an experiment, and one third of them were shown photographs of household items. And in the background of the photograph, there was an individual, a single individual standing alone. That was for one third. Another third saw those same photographs, but in the background were figures of two individuals standing apart from one another, separate. In the third group, they saw those same two individuals standing shoulder to shoulder in a togetherness, partnership, sort of cooperative pose.
Right.
Then, in all of the instances, the researcher got up from the table and pretended to drop a series of items onto the floor by accident. And the question was, who gets off the chair, down on their hands and knees, and helps the researcher pick up these items of the three types of subjects? And there's no question. Those who saw the two individuals standing together in a togetherness, unity, cooperative kind of pose were three times more likely to help, because the mindset of togetherness and unity was installed. Now, here's the most amazing thing about that study. Not that they were able to triple the likelihood of assistance. It's that the subjects in this experiment were 18 months old.
Oh, wow.
They were babies, hardly able to talk, barely able to think, to reflect or review. And yet this process is so fundamental to human functioning, so primitive, that even 18-month-old children were mobilized by it.
Very strong. And another question, this is a song. Why has Like a Rolling Stone by Is it the Rolling Stones? No. Who sings
Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan, of course. Yes, I got confused. Why has it been voted the greatest pop song of all time?
It was rated the greatest pop song of all time by one particular magazine, Rolling Stone magazine. Do you know what their number two song was?
Something by the Rolling Stones?
Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones.
Uh-huh.
Now, when I saw that, I looked at other ratings of the greatest songs of rock and roll history. Not one of them rated those two songs in their top two. Only Rolling Stone magazine, because of the association,
yeah,
the persuasive association that made them like these songs, mm-hmm, because their name was the Rolling Stones, was Rolling Stone magazine, right? So again, the state, what's prominent in our consciousness before we experience something biases the way we process that subsequent information to be consistent with what is prominent in consciousness.
And in your opinion, what is the greatest pop song?
I like House of the Rising Sun by The Animals.
Oh, okay, yeah, good choice. Great, okay, now if we move over to the workplace, when looking for a job, so you're a job seeker, what takeaways from persuasion could you employ to incline your evaluators to be more favorable to your candidacy?
Yeah, well, you know, when we go into a job interview, frequently there's an evaluator sitting across the table. Sometimes it's a small team,
yeah,
of evaluators,
yeah,
a panel. And we typically are trained to say, well, thank you for bringing me here today. I want to answer all of your questions. I'm going to recommend that before we launch in to the interview, we say one more thing. But I'm curious, why did you invite me here today? What was it about my candidacy that attracted you to my application? And what you will find is they will then put themselves in a mindset of describing your strengths. What were the reasons that you were brought in, that your candidacy was seen to be attractive to this organization? Now, when they go through the interview, it will be with that mindset.
Right, yeah.
I have an acquaintance who claims he's gotten 3 straight better jobs using that tactic.
That's interesting, and I could see that working in a sales meeting, too.
In a sales meeting, too, where you're in competition with rivals,
yeah,
and they're coming in to making presentations, you should ask ahead of time, why did you select us to come in today?
Because of the fluffy clouds on the website. Okay, and so once you secure that job, let's say you know, you're in your third one, and you're going really well, what might you do then to increase the chances that your boss will support an ideal or an initiative that you want to be associated with?
Yeah, so suppose you've now got that job that you wanted and you want to rise within the ranks, and you have a particular idea that you think will be well received by other employees and will increase the outcomes of the organization. But you need to get your boss's support for it, maybe a budget or some kind of verbal support. So what we typically are trained to do is to develop a draft of our idea, maybe a blueprint of it, and then give it to the boss and say, I would love to get your opinion on this before I suggest it, right? Before we move forward with it. Asking for feedback from your boss is the right thing. Asking for his or her opinion is the wrong thing to say persuasively, Because the research shows that when you ask for someone's opinion, he or she takes a step back from you psychologically and goes inside to find the answer. If instead of asking for an opinion, we ask for the boss's advice on our plan, he or she takes a step toward us.
Right.
In a kind of partnership state of mind when reviewing our draft, our proposal. Right? And the research shows we will get more support for that idea if we ask for the boss's opinion, excuse me, the boss's advice rather than opinion.
So, okay, that's very interesting. So what's an example question? And how do you differentiate between advice and opinion?
By the word you use.
Yes.
Just, it's simply a word.
You say, can I have your advice?
Versus, can I have your opinion?
Right.
Or your expectation. They also tested expectation, which did the worst of any of them. Right? Because again, it's asking you to go in to yourself. Now, take a step back from me and be an objective observer of the pros and cons of my idea, rather than take a step for me and be my partner in this, be part of this project. Right? You know, there's an old saying, when we ask for advice, we're typically looking for an accomplice. Now, what the new research says is that if we get that advice, we typically get that accomplice.
Right.
And what better accomplice, what better partner to have an idea, on an idea, than someone in charge?
Yeah, yeah. Get the boss on board.
Yeah.
And so when you persuade people you influence them or, you say you move people to opinion and so on, I'm surely this can backfire sometimes. And do you have any examples of what not to do?
You know, here's something that a friend of mine who is a marketing professor did a while ago. He decided to find the single most effective influence strategy, the one that would be most effective across the widest range of situations and populations and circumstances. Right? And I saw him at a conference a while ago. He caught me by the arm. He said, Bob, I found it. I found the single most effective strategy for an influence professional. It is not to have a single influence strategy.
Hey, interesting.
That's the mistake. To think that the same approach, even though it might be your favorite, is going to work in all situations,
right,
with all recipients, with all forms of history with you and or your product or your service, that's just naive. So you have to change your approach in each instance depending on the circumstances and the audience.
And so philosophically as well, you could argue that do we really need to influence and persuade people? You could say that, you know, we are trying to manipulate people. What's your take on that?
I think that's an important distinction between influence on the one hand, manipulation on the other.
Mm-hmm.
Manipulation is to use strategies of influence in a deceptive way to mislead people into assent. Influence is to use strategies in an educational way. You inform people into assent. I saw a study from Beijing, China, shows you the cross-cultural reach of this particular tactic, which is that people want to follow the lead of similar others. What have other people like me done in this situation? So what the owners of a string of restaurants in Beijing did was to simply put a star next to certain items on their menu that signified, this is one of our most popular dishes. And each one immediately became 13 to 20% more popular. just by pointing to something that was true.
Yeah.
Right? That's what I mean by influence. And I'm happy to be a recipient of that influence. If I come to that restaurant, I want to know what's the most popular.
I'd appreciate that, yeah.
Yeah, because now I know what people around me, like me, have decided is the best option here. And I'm more willing to say yes to that option, more willing to get a good outcome, more likely to get a good outcome as a consequence.
And I also, I'd like you to talk about this, the NHS in this country. I believe they employ some of your research and techniques. And what were the outcomes?
So, for example, this same principle of what we call social proof, telling people honestly what the majority of others around them are doing, right? So, this is a story of the tax service rather than the NHS, but the tax service. They sent a letter to people who were delinquent on their taxes, telling them that they were delinquent and specifying the negative consequences, the fines and penalties that would be associated unless they sent their money within a specific time. And that letter produced about a 67% compliance rate. If they simply said the majority of citizens do pay their taxes on time, that went from 67% to 73% compliance. And if they said the majority of citizens in your community pay your taxes on time, in other words, similar others, that went to 83% by just pointing to something that was true. Was enough to produce the desired response.
Interesting. And if we look at brands and organizations and governments are employing these type of techniques, is there one shining example in your mind?
Well, I think the UK is doing a terrific job with what it calls its nudge unit, right? That produces all kinds of experiments that allow people to see information that makes them choose healthier options, more beneficial options, saving more for retirement, eating more healthy food, and so on, just by pointing out certain kinds of information in an influential way. So I think that unit, which is now a model for such units around the world, the United States now has one. They have one in New Zealand. They have one now in Qatar. So they're spreading all over the world because governments recognize that we can move people toward positive policies without spending any money to do it. We don't have to penalize them with fines. We don't have to incent them with discounts and rebates and so on for using cost or for using energy efficient material. We just give them honest information about what their neighbors are doing, and they tend to move in the direction of a desirable choice.
Great. Interesting that. Right. Final question. Where can our listeners, where can they connect with yourself? And also, where can they find the new book?
Well, we have a website. It's called influenceatwork.com. That's all one word, influenceatwork.com. And they can find information about Persuasion, that book. They can find information about my previous books and also my schedule for speaking or doing training within organizations.
Are you on Twitter and LinkedIn and all these places?
We are.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, Dr. Robert Cialdini, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, I hope you got a lot out of that chat. Dr. Robert Cialdini is a true gentleman and a scholar. Everything that we discussed, everything that he mentioned, will of course be in the show notes article, and all the show notes articles can be found at linkhumans.com/podcast. Now, finally, would you like your company, brand, or product featured on this podcast. You don't have to write a groundbreaking book. All I ask is that you are an innovator in recruiting HR marketing and that you're willing to share your insights. So if you want to team up and make some podcast magic, just get in touch with me for a full media kit and email me at jorgen@linkhumans.com and we'll take it from there. That's it for this week. Many thanks for tuning in and I look forward to catching up with you next time.
Let me give you an example of how the difference between being coerced, how being a coercive influencer can backfire. Right? There was a guy back in the 1960s and 70s in the United States who was an interviewer, and he was known for being very caustic and attacking of the people who would come on his show. His name was Joe Pyne. People said that the reason he was so hostile to everyone, he was embittered to life by a leg amputation that he had had. Other people said, no, he was just a mean guy. Right? But, and then he had the rock star Frank Zappa come on. Right? And this was at a time when long hair on men was unusual. So Zappa sat down and Joe Pyne immediately said to him, so, I guess your long hair makes you a girl. And Zappa replied immediately, then I guess your wooden leg makes you a table.